Thank
you.
half a lecture, yes. Now we get on to the other half then, and I think you can ask questions at the end as well, and the questions at the end of the second half need not relate only to the second half. You can relate to the first half as well. There are no rules. So now to get on to the second half, what I've tried to do is to set up a particular kind of argument about our contemporary understanding of religion and also about a particular colonial understanding of religion, right? And what I'm going to do here is to look at the north of India now in the first section and the south of India in the second section, and to look at the different histories of Hinduism within that geographical space. This is to show you what I'm trying to do is to break down the picture of Hinduism for you. So there are different histories in North India and different history in South India. And as you shall soon realize as I speak, I argue that the history of South India represents something that is more progressive and so on. That's also because I come from South India. Right? So, and this is something that, as of course, one needs to know about all writing of history as well, that you need to figure out where the historian is coming from when they make their argument. You know, there is a very subjective position. There was a time long ago when I was a child where we were taught that history is objective. It's about scientific, rational facts and so on and so forth. I think we forgot that lesson soon as we stepped out of the classroom, because we could see there was no objectivity around us. Right? Objectivity is not a fact of lived life. So how do we understand Hinduism as it came to be understood in North India in the colonial period, right, from around the late 19th century through to 1947? So one of the things that I think is crucial to an understanding of Hinduism in North India is also how an entire tradition comes to be built around the Ramayana, which, as you may know, all of you may know, some of you may know, or none of you may know, is one of the major epics within the Indian religious tradition. It tells the story of the virtuous god Rama, virtuous as, in some ways. How many of you are familiar with the Ramayana? Otherwise, telling the story of the Ramayana sometimes takes 36 days and nights. Yeah? So this could go on forever. Is the story of the Ramayana familiar to most of you? Right? Or maybe... Okay, brief version. Just and virtuous king and evil demon. Just and virtuous king has beautiful wife. Demon desires the beautiful wife. Demon carries away beautiful wife. Just and righteous king goes in pursuit of demon, kills demon, recovers virtuous wife, and then questions her virtue because she spent time away from him. As a result of which she's banished. She dies, goes back to her mother, she's born on Mother Earth, but not before granting two sons to the virtuous king so that the virtuous kingship can continue. Yeah? So that's the story. Now there are many other incidents in between involving superhuman efforts and a stunning cast of animals and so on and so forth. Yeah? A lot of extras. So when we think about the Ramayana, the whole tradition of Ram and the worship of Ram as the virtuous, just paragon of virtue comes to be prevalent all over North India, particularly from the 18th century onward to the setting up of the Hindu kingdom of Banaras in northern India. Right? Banaras is also the holy city. It's like, you know, as Hindu fundamentalists would say, it's a Jerusalem of India. Right? Banaras is where the Raja of Banaras creates a Hindu kingship. Remember, northern India was largely ruled by the Mughals for a considerable part of its the Muslim reign of the Mughals. So the Raja of Banaras creates a Hindu kingship. He creates a Hindu kingship around the figure of Rama so as to allow people the misunderstanding that perhaps he himself is a virtuous king like Rama. And the Rama tradition comes to flourish all over North India. Now what is important here about the Rama tradition, and this is something that will go back to the question that was raised there, is that within the Rama tradition, there is a perception of hierarchy as being a benevolent thing. Right? So throughout the story of the Ramayana, you find Rama killing lower castes for reciting the Vedas, because they're not supposed to recite the Vedas, only the Brahmins are, and this is seen as a good thing. It's seen as delivering the world from an evil. It's also seen as sending the lowest caste right up to heaven. Of course, if you're killed by Rama, what else could happen? You'll go straight up to heaven. Or there are stories of Rama attacking people by employing guile and deception, killing people by hiding behind a tree. There's a particular incident, and that again is presented as something that is noble. It had to be done because it is only if somebody dies at Rama's hands that they would go to heaven. And that's the kind of argument that's constantly said. So the Ramayana tradition also strengthens a notion of hierarchy, right? Which puts the Brahmin and the king and the upper caste at the top and puts the lower caste right at the bottom, in a justifiable kind of hierarchy, right? So if colonialism creates a hierarchy of texts, right, creates Hinduism in the mode of the Brahminical text, there is local religious tradition as buttressed by kingship, which also creates a particular notion of Hinduism in which lower castes have their place. So the prevalence of the Rama tradition is something that we need to think about. The other text, the Mahabharata, is not a text that Hindu fundamentalists use, because it is a text that is fundamentally morally ambivalent as to what is right, what is wrong. The end of the Mahabharata is a war in which there is victory, but there are no victors. Right? It is a very, very morally complex text. But it's not something, obviously, that renders itself easily to political manipulation. So the Ramayana and the Ram tradition is central to northern India. Now, what happens with the coming of colonialism is that, as we know, under colonialism, there are subjects, but not citizens. Citizens are the functions of a democratic space, the growth of a public sphere, and so on. So, under colonialism, the public sphere, the public space is something that is a space from which the Indian intellectual is denied entry, the Indian political being is denied entry. They are not incorporated in administration. They are not appointed to higher levels of the bureaucracy, and so on and so forth. So what we are thinking about here is a division that emerges, where the public space is something that is ruled by colonialism. The only space for action that is allowed for Indians is within the private sphere, in a reconstitution of tradition, a re-understanding of religion, a re-understanding of caste, and so on. So you have the creation of a modern space ruled by colonialism, which, as a recent political scientist has said, which is morally empty. The real moral debates are happening in the private sphere, but they are happening through an engagement with caste and religion. So in the late 19th century, when under pressure from nationalism, the public sphere begins to open up. The colonial government grants concessions. There is local self-government, there is municipal administration, and so on. And local elites begin to enter the public domain. They bring with them ties of caste, ties of religion, and old other forms of mobilization. So you can see that the public sphere, the distinction that we make between state, civil society, community, the ideal kind of division, that wasn't possible under colonialism, because community always leaked into civil society. Now, is that something that's clear? Or is that something that you would like me to explain? Or maybe another time? Yeah. Okay. So when we think about the evolution of a public sphere under colonialism, which is what I'm arguing here, the public sphere comes to be influenced by questions of religion and caste. It's not a space where people enter as individuals without these other identities. Okay? Now, one of the things that we need to think about here is that what happens as a result of this is that the colonial public space is a space within which people begin to interact as Hindus and Muslims, right? Members of different religions. And here I would like to speak about four things that happen which actually generate a political problem. So if religion and caste are brought into the public sphere as factors of politics rather than just general well-being, why does this become a problem? This becomes a problem because from the late 19th century, the colonial government starts the census operations. You know, the idea of the census, where you enumerate people. So you count the number of Hindus, you count the number of Muslims, you count the number of people who are agriculturalists, etc., etc., etc. So what it introduces into the political sphere is the idea of the superiority of numbers, that numbers matter. Because if you have to be politically represented, you have to be a large community. If you choose to represent a community, you have to say, I represent a community of 100,000 rather than a community of 30,000. So suddenly, the census begins to introduce into the public sphere the idea that numbers matter. It also introduces a conflictual relation between the Hindus and the Muslims. So one kind of rhetoric, one kind of discourse that comes into existence is that of the dying Hindu, that the Hindus are losing their numbers, the Muslims are increasing in number. What we need to do is to increase our numbers. Right? And how do we increase our numbers? We need to increase our numbers by preventing lower castes from converting to other religions. There is a bleeding of Hinduism, right, where lower castes are leaving us, becoming Muslims, becoming Christians. So the first efforts at organization, political organization, work on the fact that the politics of numbers that colonialism has introduced through the census begins to impact on the idea that larger numbers are necessary. Hindus need to reform themselves, otherwise they will lose their entire constituency to Muslims. So it's an antagonistic relation that comes up. The second factor that happens is that colonial government chooses to deal again with so-called leaders of the community. So since the public sphere is something that doesn't really exist, we're speaking about subjecthood rather than citizenship, the colonial government, when it chooses to engage with native society, they say, we deal with the leader. It's like those cartoons that you have of Martians landing on Earth and saying, take me to your leader. It's a bit like that. So once you ask for a leader, there are several people who present themselves as leaders. So what you have is a way in which the politics of religion and community tend to get exacerbated, because these self-styled leaders, who are the only people that colonialism will recognize, have to draw upon entities other than a pure discourse of citizenship in order to have numbers behind them. So this is, I'm summarizing a whole set of arguments that have been made by a whole range of historians here. So within this argument is contained possibly around 5 books and 10 articles. It's like a condensed pill that I'm giving you. So the census operations, then we're thinking about the colonial policy of recognizing leaders of the community. We're also thinking about the creation of a public sphere in which upper caste interests are predominant. Right, the lower castes are consistently excluded. So you have the growth of a literate press, you have the growth of newspapers, you have the growth of journals, but people participating in all of these are upper caste intellectuals who define Hinduism in particular ways, who define Hinduism in their own image. So what you have in existence is something that is quite explosive. Colonialism introduces a divide among the communities through a politics of numbers. Within Hinduism, it comes to be defined by the upper caste intellectuals, who are the only people who have access to that whole paraphernalia of communication and so on. So Hinduism again comes to be defined by the indigenous Hindu in upper caste terms. Just as colonialism did it with the text, now upper caste Hindus represent Hinduism as their province. So all of these lead to an exclusion of questions of hierarchy. Hinduism does not question itself. What it does is to present itself as a religion which has been in existence for ages. It presents itself as eternal. It presents itself as something that has existed from the dawn of time. It draws upon images of the Ramayana, right, which is a strong tradition in northern India, with its notion of hierarchy, of benevolent hierarchy. It excludes all considerations of inequality and hierarchy from within it. So what does this mean? Does this mean that there are no counter discourses? Does this mean that there are no other voices? What you have are two options which are emerging, particularly among the lower castes, that there are a whole lot of lower caste religious sects which come into existence in colonial India as well, which is what was referred to earlier. A lot of them argue on the grounds of a larger humanity. They argue that all human beings should be equal, the human soul is one with the godly soul, and so on. They draw upon high philosophy, but they render it into simple relations between human beings. But a lot of them choose to stay outside of Hinduism as well. They say, well, we are not Hindus. Right? We are lower caste groups who want to redefine religion in a different way. We want to speak about a religion in which all human beings are equal. We are not Hindu. So they tend to stand apart from this. Or you have movements where there are a lot of, particularly in Eastern India, you have lower caste groups who become upwardly mobile, yeah, and tend to take action against the upper caste, boycotting their functions, staying away from modes of labor and so on. So what you have here is a Hinduism which is consolidating itself around an upper caste identity faced with an upwardly mobile lower caste group. And what you have as a resolution of this problem is a deflection of that problem outwards. Okay? So when we think about the problem of communalism in modern India, which is the conflict that arises between Hindu and Muslim, one must primarily understand it as a problem that is within Hinduism itself. Right? That in North India at least, the question of internal hierarchy, the difference between Hindu and Hindu, some Hindus are more equal than others. Right? So the difference between Hindu and Hindu comes to be presented as a problem that should be directed outward. So as the lower castes try to move up, they are sought to be incorporated within Hinduism, and that movement is directed outwards against the Muslims. So the whole problem of inequality within Hinduism comes to be presented as a problem that is directed in violence at the other, the Muslim. Right? So communalism, or the inimical relations, the relations of enmity between Hindus and Muslims, is also a problem of the non-resolution of the issue of the fundamental inegalitarianism that is present within Hinduism. So the problem of the violence of the Hindu against the Muslim is a problem of the violence within Hinduism itself. Right? Now that's the case of North India. Now what about South India? South Indian public sphere, or in South India, the question of hierarchy comes to be addressed from the very beginning. Right? And South India, as those who study modern India know, South India has been relatively free of this conflict between Hindu and Muslim. There are a whole host of reasons, right, which we shan't get into. It'll take us back another 300 years. But what we need to understand about South India is also that South India, as you know, is like that. Right? There's no chalk here, but South India are like that. Voila!
This looks more like a pizza. So if you think about North India and South India, North India relates to the land. It's all surrounded by land. Here you have South India, which is open to the sea on all sides. And different parts of South India are incorporated into different parts of the world, really. So this part of South India relates to China and Southeast Asia. This part of South India is engaged in trade with West Asia, sometimes as far west as Venice and Amsterdam, and so on. So you're thinking about a history of South India which is open to many, many more influences. The first Christian communities are in South India. The first Jewish communities, following the fall of Jerusalem, you have a large immigration of Jews into the southern state of Kerala. The early Muslim presence, dating from around the 8th century AD, is again in South India. The earliest mosque in India is in South India, right? It's a different history that we're talking about because of that influence. So we're also thinking about a region which is a frontier region in some sense. It's a frontier of several cultures, a convergence of several cultures, a society that is much more open. It's colonialism that closes it in. So when we think about these borders, remember that these are post-1947 borders. Like India is much vaster than this. And we're thinking, this is something that those of you who have read Fernand Braudel's work on capitalism and material life. One of the things that he argues is that if you look at India, you shouldn't see the post-1947 shape. At one point, This part of India related to the Turkish Ottoman Empire and the Safavid Empire in Persia. This related to the Chinese empires and so on, what I've just told you, right?
So we're thinking about a much more open entity. Colonialism has shut down our imagination into the nation state. The nation state represents a very recent imagination. That's something that we need to remember. So when we say Germany, India, and so on, this is a very, very recent invention. Our countries are much larger. Our mental universes are much larger. The nation state has shut down our imaginations. It has policed it. It has built the wall around our minds, right? The wall which came down in 1989. There's another wall of the nation state in our heads. So the South Indian sphere has been open to various influences. And what we have in South India, along with the history of the ocean, is the history of Christianity. So starting from around the 16th century onwards, you have the presence of Jesuit priests, right? So you have Roberto de Nobili, the Italian Besci, a whole lot of them were also Jesuits, were also moving into China and Japan, as some of you may know from the works of Jonathan Spence, for example. And so there has been, one, an openness to other worlds. There has been the presence of several major religions, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism in South India. There's also been the presence of a Christian engagement with Hinduism, which consists of a critique. So this missionary critique of Hinduism, which comes about here, means that there is a different understanding of Hinduism as well, because the missionaries are interested in a polemic. You understand a polemic which makes an intellectual argument against the validity of Hinduism, based not on the Vedas, not on the Upanishads, but on what are called the Puranas. The Puranas consist of several legends and stories about the gods. It's a bit like reading the X-rated stuff in the Old Testament. So similarly, within Hinduism, you have a lot of these stories about gods dallying with one another, stories of incest among gods, and so on and so forth. So the missionaries hone in on that. So if in North India it's the Vedas and Upanishads and so on which are being spoken about and has been constituted as the Hinduism, here the missionaries say, well, Hinduism is the Puranas. And look at what you have in the Puranas, 10-headed gods, 20-headed creatures, and they're all, and so is this your religion? Does this constitute a valid religion? They also bring with them the debates that between Catholicism and Protestantism in Europe. Where they, as I said, they begin to see Hinduism as an unreformed Catholicism. So starting from around the 18th century, there's a text produced by Bartholomeus Ziegenbalg. Right? And Ziegenbalg has an entire representation of Hinduism, where you can see that it actually seems to me to be a description of Catholicism rather than of Hinduism. His description of priests, his description of the spiritual excess, his description of the profusion of gods and beings that are worshipped. Right? So what you have here is an understanding of Hinduism which is based on critique, and an understanding of Hinduism that is based on the Puranas rather than the Vedas and the Upanishads. And this indeed is what comes to be taken up in the centuries that follow. So not the Vedas, not the Sanatan Dharma, but a critique of the Puranas. And once you have a lower caste mobility happening through an engagement with indentured labor across the ocean, cultivation of cash crops, so on, the whole lot of economic forces which generates an upwardly mobile lower caste group. What happened to the upwardly mobile lower caste groups in North India? They get absorbed as the shock troops of Hinduism against Islam, against Muslims. Here, the lower caste mobility actually reflects itself in a carrying on of the missionary critique of Hinduism. And there are several positions that come up, and here again I shall summarize the positions for you, because as I realize I'm just one point in a large course which Professor Dharampal teaches, so maybe you can come back to some of these issues later. So there are four positions that I mentioned here. One is a position from southern India, so southwest. There's a gentleman called Narayana Guru who comes from the Irava caste of toddy tappers, and the castes were engaged in getting alcohol from the coconut palm. So he argues that, and of course the coconut palm is also a very fairly profitable crop, right? And coconut oil was exported in the late 19th century to make fine soaps for Parisian high society. Right? So there is a larger market culture that we are speaking about here as well. So Narayana Guru argues that when we think about ourselves and when we think about our upward mobility, we need to see that we are different from Hinduism. We can stand outside Hinduism. We can have our own temples. If the upper caste do not allow us entry in their temples, we create our own temples. It's a rugged, one could say late Victorian philosophy of self-help that Narayana Guru is adopting. And here again, it's important to think about the various currents that go into people's thoughts. There is no Indian way of thinking, just as much as there is no European way of thinking. We have to think about the long histories that inform each of those identities. Okay? So Narayana Guru argues that there are Iravar temples. And when he sets up a temple to the Lord Shiva, he says, this is an Irava Shiva. This is not a Brahman Shiva. This is my God. This is my Shiva. It's like somebody were to say, well, this is my Jesus, not your Jesus. Right? It's that kind of argument. It's a very radical argument that he's making. Then you have, further north, in the state of Maharashtra, again, a man who comes from a gardener caste. There is a recurring pattern here. These are all lower castes who are engaging with the worldwide cash crop economy. Right? Here it's coconut. There it's the gardener caste, a man called Jyotiba Phule. And Jyotiba Phule draws upon the experience of the United States. He reads Thomas Paine. He writes a book called Gulamgiri or Slavery, which he dedicates to the black slaves of America who won freedom. Right? Here, you're thinking about another world. It's not the claustrophobic world of North India. You're thinking about where a man in Maharashtra can identify with the plight of black slaves, identify with the American Civil War, identify with notions of dignity that come from across several thousand miles across the ocean. So Phule argues that Hinduism represents nothing but a Brahmin fraud. He says, what is Hinduism? It is something that the Brahmins have created in order to generate hierarchy, in order to put all of us in our place. And he writes a series of texts in which he argues that what we need to do is to rewrite Hinduism. We need to rewrite these texts because these are texts of power. Right? The Veda is not a religious text. He says these are political texts. These are political texts written by those who wish to continue in power. And so he has an entire reading, and there again the wonderful studies of Jyotiba Phule, including a new set of his translations, including his powerful book called Slavery, which he dedicated, and I can give you the reference to that. The third is a set of people who make an even more original argument, particularly from the region of Tamil Nadu in the south, who argue that Hinduism is not the religion of India, who argue that Hinduism is certainly not the oldest religion in India. They argue that Buddhism is the oldest religion in India. And why do they argue that Buddhism is the oldest religion? Because they say Buddhism was about equality. Buddhism was not about hierarchy. Buddhism was not about one group of people dominating others. It represented that original equal state of humanity. And Hinduism represents the triumph of a Brahminical culture, again, which breaks up Buddhism, and the original Buddhists became the lowest castes. That's the argument that's put forward. That Buddhism, so when you think about the history of Hinduism, Hinduism is a political argument, again, similar to what Narayana Guru and the others would argue, that Buddhism is the original religion and the original Buddhists were the lower caste defeated by Brahminical religion. And there's Yotithas, who's an early 20th century philosopher, of a lower caste philosopher, and you have also B.R. Ambedkar, who was our first Minister of Law in independent India, also the person who was responsible for the Constituent Assembly, who drafted the Constitution of India, right? A man who studied, did his PhD in the United States and so on. He was the most educated lower caste man of his time. Now, B.R. Ambedkar also, at the end of his life, converts to Buddhism in 1956. So the most important lower caste intellectual in modern India had no life within Hinduism possible. A man whose life history ran parallel to the nationalist movement finally realizes that there is no place for Hinduism. And those of you who do manage to read his autobiography, it's important to remember the personal experience of being a lower caste. We forget that caste is about violence. It's not about hierarchy. So B.R. Ambedkar goes to England to study. He goes to America, gains higher education. He comes back. In his first job in the state of Maharashtra, he has Brahmins who work under him throw files at him because they cannot touch him because he's an untouchable. It's from there that starts his career where he says, I shall no longer work within a bureaucracy, I shall work as a political being. And then he gets to write the constitution. And this, you must remember, is a remarkable fact. It's almost as if a black American were to write the constitution of America. Right? And you think that B.R. Ambedkar, an untouchable, rights, is responsible for framing the Indian constitution. It's a radical move. It's also a tragedy that he then converts to Buddhism. And finally, you have the movement again in Tamil Nadu by a man called, who known by his initials, E.V.R. Right? Like most Hollywood Hindi film villains who are known by the initials J.K. or those of you who remember Dallas will remember. So E.V.R., E.V. Ramaswamy Naikar, who argues that it's important not to succumb to any religion. And he argues from the grounds of atheism and socialism, the experience of the Russian Revolution. And all over Tamil Nadu, you will find statues of E.V. Ramaswamy Naikar bearing the words that are there on your page. There is no God. Whoever believes in God is a fool. Right? So there are statues all over Tamil Nadu which carry this inscription. So all these options are present within South India, where Narayana Guru creates a critique of Hinduism, Phule creates a critique of Hinduism, so does Ambedkar. And these then generate a whole set of positions where there are several lower caste engagements which have transformed the entire social space. Let's go back to the beginning of the lecture. Where does Sai Baba come from? Sai Baba comes from South India. Where does Amritananda Mayi come from? Amritananda Mayi comes from South India. It's not a coincidence. They come from a tradition within which hierarchy is seen as the fundamental violence that afflicts Hinduism. Right? And thereby begins the critique. As I told you, my reading of Hinduism is something that is existential, it's political, and it's about practice. And what is interesting here are two positions that I'd like to put before you. The philosopher president of India, Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, who wrote several volumes on Indian philosophy, he said Hinduism is not a religion, it's a way of life. And for him it could be a way of life because he was there right at the top of the hierarchy. A recent Supreme Court judgment, which actually goes in the favor of the Hindu fundamentalist, says Hinduism is not a religion, it's a way of life. So that same sentence has found another meaning. The critique that E.V. Ramaswamy Naikar says, what does E.V. Ramaswamy Naikar say about Hinduism? He says Hinduism is a way of life and that is what is bad about it. He says Hinduism is a way of life because the Hindu cannot eat without thinking about caste. He cannot marry without thinking about caste. He cannot engage in politics without thinking about caste. So Hinduism is a way of life in that every aspect of their life is controlled by that hierarchy. So you see how that sentence or that phrase, Hinduism being a way of life, can mean so many different things across that spectrum, from the philosopher president to the radical lower caste intellectual. And I've given you two quotes at the end of the lecture. Now the reason why I give you these two quotes is that there is the hubris of intellectualism where we begin to think that we become intellectually more and more sophisticated in the sense that now we say, well, we have done with modernism, we are on to postmodernism, we are on to post-structuralism, we are aware of the contingency of identity, we are aware that knowledge is constructed, we are aware that there are no objective truths to be realized, and so on and so forth. I give you these two quotes, both from the late, one is from the early 1920s, 1924. The second is from Jyoti Das, also from the 1920s. And I'll just read them out, and you can see for yourself how much these quotes have informed my own lecture. My lecture can be represented as a postmodern reading of religion, can be represented as a postmodern reading of Hinduism, but in fact, it goes back more than 100 years. Right? So E.V.R., E.V. Ramaswamy Naikar, the man who says there is no God, he who believes in God is a fool. He asks, what does it mean to be a Hindu? Other religions refer to themselves through names of persons, hence we speak of the faith of Christ, the God of Muhammad, the Buddhist religion. In this sense, to whom does Hinduism belong? He's very clear. Hinduism belongs to the upper caste. It hangs at the back of the sentence. Whose doctrines gave it a name? Is it not the case that we refer to our religion using a name that is mere sound, but signifies nothing? Secondly, who created Hinduism? How old is it? These are precisely the questions that contemporary academics are asking. Who created Hinduism? There are some people who would say, well, Hinduism was invented in the colonial period. And they'd say, well, it's no more than 200 years old. And Jyotidas, the Buddhist. Buddhism was superseded by the Brahmins. No Hindu corpus except, there is no Hindu corpus except that created during British rule when Brahmins presented the Buddhist texts and Upanishads as their own. The Vedas were created when William Jones and Colebrooke and others put it into a single work. This is what contemporary scholarship is arriving at. Right? So when I presented an argument to you at the very beginning, it represented the cutting edge of social science research, a fact that was evident to somebody who lived Hinduism as violence. Right? So I'd like to stop there. Thank you.